Today is Tuesday, September 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The first U.S. presidential debate takes place Tuesday night.
This is the first of three presidential debates. The first one, though, expected to be the most important, the most watched. 100 million people are expected to be watching or listening to tonight's debate.
What's at stake for both candidates?
You know, it's winning those people that are undecided, of course, targeting the forgotten voter that the Trump campaign, you know, received in 2016. Both sides are going to go after those individuals.
We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden square off Tuesday evening in the first of three presidential debates before the November election. VOA's Caroline Persuti is at the Ohio venue, and I spoke with her to get a preview of tonight's event.
Hello from Cleveland, Ohio. It is where the nation and the world will see their two presidential candidates for the first time side by side on the same stage, answering the same questions by the same moderator. This is the first of three presidential debates. The first one, though, expected to be the most important, the most watched. 100 million people are expected to be watching or listening to tonight's debate. Now, all during the day, all during yesterday, they were running through technical rehearsals inside the huge pavilion on the grounds of Case Western Reserve University, checking the lighting, checking the sound. Each candidate will walk through the pavilion today just to see the location, to see where they'll be standing. And of course, this is a debate like none other in the history of this country, because there will be a very limited audience, only invited guests from each campaign. Each candidate will be alone on the stage. They will not be wearing masks. There will be no handshake at the beginning. So the utmost important taken for COVID, for the coronavirus, for protection, for safety. Apparently, Joe Biden's campaign has asked for two breaks during the 90-minute debate and has been denied that. Meantime, the Trump campaign has asked that the ears of a candidate be checked for listening devices, any transmissions possible. And as I understand it, that has been denied as well.
So transitioning over to the debate itself, what's the structure going to be like?
Absolutely. There will be six main topics, and each of them will be given 15-minute segments. So that includes the records of both candidates, election integrity, the coronavirus, the economy, racial unrest, the Supreme Court.
So we have those six areas of discussion for tonight, and this kicks off the debate season. So what's up next?
The next debate is next week for the vice presidential candidates, and then that's followed by two final debates for the presidential candidates, one of those being with the town hall in Miami, Florida, which that will be interesting to just see how they make sure that each of the participants in the town hall is kept safe from coronavirus. So they'll have to keep their distance, and we're not sure how they're going to use microphones for that event.
That was VOA's Caroline Persuti. Many Americans have already made up their mind about which candidate they're voting for November 3rd, and in some cases, they've already cast their ballot. As the presidential and vice presidential debates start to get underway, I asked Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert about the strategies the campaigns may employ to attract those undecided voters. We began our conversation by speaking about the current occupant of the White House, President Trump, and the strategies he may employ.
I think he's going to out-Trump Trump. He's going to be as loud and in Biden's face as he can be. I think his strategy is going to be to try to intimidate Biden to see how well Biden can stand up to the challenge. Because Trump's idea is that Biden can't handle the pressure, the acumen. He has stamina issues. You know, that's why Trump calls him Sleepy Joe. So I think Trump is going to try to be as aggressive and assertive as possible to try to see if he can, you know, show that sleepiness Joe Biden caricature that he promotes. That's what I think Trump's main going to be.
So we flip that around for Joe Biden. What is his strategy to try and prove to America that he is the person to be the next occupant of the White House?
I think he's going to do the opposite. He's going to try to downplayed what Trump has done in the past 4 years. He's going to hold Trump as accountable as possible and say, well, you didn't do this or you did this poorly. And it's really going to be a referendum on Trump's past 4 years. And Biden really wants to be in charge of that message and that narrative to show that President Trump was unworthy of being the president in 2016 through now, and that he should not be reelected because of that perceived unworthiness by the Biden campaign.
As I've mentioned, many Americans have already made up their minds and in some cases have already voted. So what's really at stake for either candidate during this debate?
You know, it's winning those people that are undecided, of course. Certainly, those fringe voters are the voters that, you know, last time voted for Hillary, but typically vote conservative, or vice versa. They voted for Trump, but they've typically voted Democrat. Nobody's, and polling's not that accurate on this, nobody is quite sure what percentage of the population that is and what percentage intend to go out and vote this time and for whom they're going to vote. So the idea is to really target those in-between voters, those reluctant voters, targeting the forgotten voter that the Trump campaign, you know, received in 2016. Both sides are going to go after those individuals to try to prove that they should vote for, you know, in Biden's case, Biden, or for Trump's case, that they should reelect him. And so I think Trump's main focus here will be on, prior to the coronavirus, how well the economy was doing. So I think that's his bread and butter campaign issue. And I think Biden's going to say, it wasn't that great, and you didn't, you know, help tread the waters properly during coronavirus, and you might have hurt the country more than ever and the economy as well.
It's just a month before the general election. If either candidate has a misstep during Tuesday's debate, is there enough time to recover?
I think so. And unless it's a catastrophic misstep, and that's what the Trump campaign is really hoping for, because Biden has not been doing that many interviews, hasn't been in that many, you know, contested situations very, very recently, whereas Trump has been increasing his media coverage and doing, you know, spontaneous press conferences, getting out there. So he really challenged Biden to see if he can cause some type of verbal slippage. Two of the episodes, the sections tonight, will be one on coronavirus and the other is going to be on race and violence. Biden's really going to hold Trump accountable for those and really make sure that Trump explains himself. And if not, and if it's not satisfactory, Biden's going to pounce on Trump for mismanaging those two situations.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University in Georgia. Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya met with French President Emmanuel Macron in the Lithuanian capital on Tuesday.
It was a wonderful meeting. He's a wonderful person. And Svetlana, I think that he is really involved in the situation in Belarus, and he promised us to do anything to help with negotiations with just for... you know, for this political crisis in our country. And he told that time is very crucial, because a lot of people are suffering because of this regime. Too many people are in jails, and he will do everything just to help to release all the political prisoners.
Tikhanovskaya went into exile in Lithuania after an August 9th presidential election, widely seen as rigged, in which President Alexander Lukashenko claimed a sixth term in office. He denies any and all electoral fraud and says the protests in the country are backed by foreign powers intent on ousting him. Daily rallies have rocked Belarus for over 7 weeks, with the largest protests drawing up to 200,000 people, and hundreds of individuals have been detained. The European Union said last week it does not recognize Lukashenko as the president of Belarus, saying his government lacks democratic legitimacy. Kuwait's emir, Sheikh Sabah al-Ahmad al-Sabah, has died. He passed away at the age of 91. He has ruled the Gulf Arab oil producer and has been a U.S. ally since 2006 and has steered its foreign policy for more than 50 years. His designated successor is his brother, the Crown Prince, Sheikh Nawaf al-Ahmad al-Sabah. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Lebanon's Prime Minister-designate, Mustafa Adib, has abandoned efforts to form a new government amid popular demands for reform. News reports say difficulties centered on Shia parties in Lebanon's parliament seeking to control the finance ministry and pick ministers. Power in Lebanon has been based on sectarian interests for many years. Political appointments and many jobs depend on belonging to one of Lebanon's religious communities, a situation that has led to corruption. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Imad Harb, director of research and analysis at the Arab Center in Washington, about the political crisis in Lebanon.
Mustafa Adib is honest. He knows he cannot really circumvent the obstacles that have been thrown in his face. Others have just kept going and for months and months, but he decided that he didn't want to waste his time, waste the time of the Lebanese and real effort that's not going to be fruitful. But this is really a very bad situation. The Lebanese cannot afford this course of action. Hezbollah and Amal, the Shia parties in the Lebanese parliament, have really taken the country hostage. They insist on taking the finance ministry, and they insist on deciding who gets what other ministries there are. At the same time, their allies also. They have allies who are insisting on certain things, but this is not necessarily about the formation of the government. I think it is a product of the U.S.-Iran conflict, which brings me to the only conclusion is that, you know, the Lebanese are not the ones who really are forming this government, and it is in Iran's hands to allow or not allow the formation of this government.
Many believe that without international pressure and the threat of freezing assets of Lebanese politicians abroad, no real change would take place in Lebanese politics. Do you agree with such an assessment?
The Shia are protecting their interests, obviously, just like any other religious and political faction in Lebanon. All of them are looking out for their own interests. The whole system in the country is corrupt and built on securing interests. International pressure can help in trying to force some people to do certain things, just like the international pressure on Hezbollah and the threat of sanctions has actually done some good in that it has limited the cooperation between Hezbollah and President Michel Aoun and his supporters. The only problem with international pressure is that it always reflects on the Lebanese. The Lebanese are suffering already from bad situation, and more pressure is going to be transferred to the Lebanese one way or the other. Diplomatic pressure is good, but I think the only problem with international pressure is that it influences badly in the Lebanese people.
Power in Lebanon has been largely based on sectarian interests, which has led to cronyism and endemic corruption. Is there a way out?
There is a way out. Obviously, the Lebanese system as we know it today is actually dead. The compromises that used to be possible since the establishment of the country are no longer possible because the country has changed so much. Political forces have changed so much. Lebanon needs a new political system, a new political system that doesn't depend on sectarian allocation of political power, establishment of a truly independent technocratic government that would lead a transitional period during which a new electoral law can be written based on proportional representation, and with Lebanon as only one electoral district without reference to people's sects or religious affiliation. This government can also conduct a free and fair parliamentary election. The new government can also start to rebuild the Lebanese economy away from its reliance on tourism and services and try to help agriculture and industry. The government should also overhaul the judicial system because all the judges are appointed according to religious quota with the political class agreeing to them, so which means that they're not really independent. Hezbollah's arms need to be confiscated. The party should become only a political party, and a strong secular Lebanese state should be built. The state that we have today in Lebanon is built on confessional allocations, and that is no longer a modern concept, and it needs to be changed.
Imad Harb is the director of research and analysis at the Arab Center in Washington. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. More than 1 million deaths have been attributed to the novel coronavirus worldwide. The bleak milestone recorded on Monday in the United States by Johns Hopkins University is greater than the population of Jerusalem or Washington, D.C. It's also more than four times the number that were killed by the 2004 earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
More than 33 million people have been infected by COVID-19 across more than 210 countries and territories, according to a Reuters tally. Deaths from coronavirus-related illnesses have doubled from 500,000 in just 3 months, led by fatalities in the United States, Brazil, and India. Those countries account for nearly half of all COVID-19 deaths globally, with the Latin American region alone responsible for more than a third of them. More than 5,400 people are dying around the world every 24 hours, according to a Reuters calculation. In the time it takes to watch a 90-minute soccer match, 340 people die on average. India is the latest epicenter of the pandemic globally and will overtake the US as the country with the most cases by the end of the year based on current trends, even as Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government pushes ahead with easing lockdown measures in a bid to jumpstart the economy. And just weeks away from the winter influenza season, the WHO has warned of a worrying spread across Western Europe. Europe accounts for nearly a quarter of coronavirus-related deaths. The high number of deaths has also led to changes in burial rites around the world, with morgues and funeral homes overwhelmed. From Bolivia to Indonesia, authorities and volunteers have had to work overtime to dig new graves and locate new burial sites.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reports health experts are encouraged by new rapid tests, which could be rolled out in as many as 20 countries in Africa alone.
Peter Sands, the executive director of the Global Fund, a partnership that works to end epidemics, says that the deployment of the quality antigen rapid diagnostic tests will be a significant step to help contain and combat the coronavirus. He says they're not a silver bullet, though, but they are highly valuable as a complement to PCR tests, since although they're less accurate, they're much faster, cheaper, and don't require a lab. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Amnesty International says it is halting its operations in India after the government froze its bank accounts. The group says the action was part of an incessant witch hunt of human rights organizations. The government has not commented on the development, but has said in the past that the rights group was being investigated for alleged violations of Indian law regarding foreign funding. The lifting of economic sanctions against Mali by a bloc of 15 West African countries will come later than first thought. This comes after the appointment of Mali's new transitional civilian prime minister, Mokhtar Ouan. ECOWAS imposed sanctions on Mali shortly after last month's coup that ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The group said it would lift sanctions after civilian leaders were appointed to govern during the transitional period. ECOWAS envoy and Nigerian ex-president Goodluck Jonathan said in a statement that the military leaders have yet to satisfy ECOWAS's demand that a civilian be named as vice president. Armenian and Azeri forces deployed heavy artillery Tuesday in the latest fighting over the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh. The Azeri Defense Ministry said the opposing forces attempted to recover lost ground by launching counterattacks in several directions. The ministry said in a statement that in the morning there was fighting around Fuzuli City and that the Armenian army shelled the Dashkasan region on the border between the two countries. Armenia denied those reports, but reported fighting throughout the night and said that the Nagorno-Karabakh army repelled attacks along the line of contact. Both sides accused one another of using heavy artillery in this week's clashes, in which dozens of people have been killed and hundreds wounded. Hong Kong has a serious housing shortage, as it is one of the most densely populated urban areas in the world. Reuters' Gloria So takes this first look at a new transitional home that's being used to address the issue.
A new apartment building in Hong Kong made out of container-like blocks left 70-year-old Lau Kai-fai and his family feeling like they had won the lottery.
Hey, Nihao.
His new 290-square-foot flat is relatively spacious by Hong Kong standards. Hong Kong is one of the most crowded urban areas in the world, and Lau is one of the first beneficiaries of the city's latest attempt to address this by building transitional homes for people waiting for public housing. His new space is a far cry from apartments in other big cities like London or Tokyo. But it's more than triple the size of where him and his family used to live, cramped in a subdivided flat otherwise known as one of Hong Kong's infamous coffin homes. Lau's wife, Tian Jiayu,
The place where we used to live was very small, and the dining table was also very small. You can't put more than two or three bowls on it. We have to take turns to have meals. Our family could not eat at the same dinner table before, but now we can have meals together.
But not all locals are as lucky as Lau's family, who can bide their time in a temporary flat for the next 2 years. On average, the wait for public housing can stretch to over 5 years. More than 200,000 Hong Kongers living in subdivided flats are on the wait list. 37-year-old Coco Chan is one of them. She's currently crammed into an 80-square-foot flat with her husband and 7-year-old son.
The space is too small and there's no room for activities. My son can only stay on his bed or here in the living room, and now he can't even go out. We used to take him to the park nearby, but now he can't because of the health crisis. We can only stay at home.
As of June, 800 transitional homes have been built so far, out of the 15,000 being planned over the next 3 years. They're being constructed on idle land leased by the government or private developers for only a few years, although the building's parts can be moved around and reused. But the project doesn't come without challenges like lack of land and money. A spokesman for the Transport and Housing Bureau told Reuters the government launched a nearly $650 million funding scheme in June to support transitional housing projects by NGOs. But NGOs say the government isn't doing enough. With more than 1 million of Hong Kong's 7.5 million residents being squeezed into poverty, the pressure is still on to find more permanent solutions to the city's serious housing shortage.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. You'll be able to find up-to-date news and world information on our website. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has long been the world's most generous provider of health and humanitarian assistance to people around the world. This assistance is provided with the support of the American taxpayer, with the reasonable expectation that it will serve a useful purpose and reach those in need. Unfortunately, the World Health Organization, or WHO, has failed badly by those measures. Not only in its response to COVID-19, but to other health crises in recent decades, said State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortegas in a statement. In addition, WHO has declined to adopt urgently needed reforms, starting with demonstrating its independence from the Chinese Communist Party. As a result, the United States announced its official withdrawal from the WHO effective on July 6, 2021. The United States' commitment to health assistance abroad remains strong. In the lead-up to the withdrawal, the administration is examining ways to leverage the expertise of key U.S. government departments and agencies and the U.S. private sector to deliver essential support rapidly to other countries to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease outbreaks at their source and humanitarian emergencies. Since 2001, the U.S. government has contributed more than $142 billion to help prevent, detect, and treat HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, Ebola, and other dangerous diseases and conditions. We give an average of $10 billion per year for global health, and this year it will be double that as we surge to fight COVID-19 worldwide, said USAID Assistant Administrator for Global Health, Dr. Alma Golden. The United States is determined to ensure that its withdrawal from WHO does not affect the level of its overall health assistance to the most vulnerable. The United States leads the world in health and humanitarian aid through an All of America effort, added Dr. Golden, and we are committed to ensuring that our generosity directly reaches people around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.